attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. This week, we buried the Call to Action brand in a big hole, filled it with expensive soil and top-quality poo, and gently crooned Boys to Men songs at it, all in order to earn a professional intervention from the planet's premier brand grower, Professor Byron Sharp. Respected all over the brand world and far beyond for his pioneering research into brand, consumer behaviour, and the role advertising plays in decision-making, Professor Byron is the rarest of all commodities in the marketing world, a genuine expert. How Brands Grow, his iconic book, is one of the definitive texts among senior business leaders, while his list of prestigious academic roles and achievements would make you physically unable to ever again look your graduation photo in the eye. We would rather selfishly like to add that the professor has also been one of the kindest and most generous supporters of our own Gasp book. Adele writes an ad. Byron says, if you're a little bit hard to buy or don't come to mind, guess what? You won't get chosen. He also says, I'm sick of podcasts that ask the same thing. So here we go. Welcome to the show, Byron.
Okay, welcome. Yes.
Right, 7 quick fires, Byron. Adelaide or Auckland?
Adelaide.
Theory or practice?
Well, there's nothing as practical as a good theory.
Well answered. Customer personas or astrology?
There's no difference.
Right, Singapore or Bordeaux?
Bordeaux.
Market research or marketing science?
Oh, well, both have their place.
Yeah. I learnt a word from Professor Malcolm Wright, to generalizability on that one. Lovely stuff. 2 more. Andrew Ehrenberg or Frank Bass?
Oh, I have to say Andrew Ehrenberg. I worked with Andrew.
Nice. These are too easy. And lastly, Tony the Tiger or Albert the Owl?
Oh, I have to go for Albert the Owl, but, you know, Tony the Tiger is pretty cool too.
Yeah. Lovely. Oh, well, listen, Byron, thank you so much for joining us. You have no idea how much I appreciate this. I'm afraid I must insist on asking you, even just briefly, on your history and how you found yourself into Ehrenberg Bass Institute. I know it's probably old ground, but it's a key question for the show. So can you tell our listeners about your first ever jobs and then how you found yourself where you are now?
Well, the reason I chose Adelaide rather than Auckland, because I was born in Auckland, but I chose Adelaide. And when I came to Adelaide, I worked for Dun & Bradstreet, a big American corporate. And then I worked for a while as the marketing manager for TechSearch, which was the university's commercialization company. And that's how I fell into academia. That was a very pivotal. I mean, it taught me that the world was very keen on finding out discoveries. And if academics made real discoveries, the real world would be certainly happy to fund that research. You just had to make real discoveries. You said very kindly at the start that I'm a genuine expert, which is a rare thing. It is quite bizarre, isn't it, that you can have marketing academics who are considered at the absolute top of their field who don't actually know very much about marketing. I mean, that would not happen for the top heart surgery researcher would be in great demand for heart surgeons. But there's a lot of people who have fabulous publishing records and things, but actually don't know very much about marketing at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's certainly fair to say. If we rewound even more, did a young Byron, like a teenage Byron, have any intention to go into academia? And if not, what were you planning?
No. My mum was a primary school teacher. No, I went to university and studied management, thinking that would be useful, get a well-paid job or something. But I was really put off by what Andrew Ehrenberg would call sonking, the scientification of non-knowledge, you know, just ridiculous theoretical frameworks that couldn't predict anything.
Okay.
And Whereas the marketing seemed to be quite practical. You know, it told you about companies, how they had to work out this difficult thing of what is it that people might buy. So I like, you know, as a, like, you know, 18-year-old, I thought, this is business. So that's how I sort of fell into marketing and then later fell into academia. I mean,
yeah,
no, never intended. Turned out quite well.
Yeah, no, of course it has, absolutely. But I always try and unpick the early years as if there's some kind of linear route that people follow, and almost always there isn't, or, you know, luck plays a huge role and serendipity and the like. But I wondered if there was any kind of analytical background.
There are some career academics, you know, people who go to university and then do...
never leave.
Do a PhD, which is the sort of union card. And yeah, so that's not uncommon, even in business disciplines, and super common, I think, in areas like chemistry. No, I think it helps to go out to the real world before you do
that.
Yeah,
no, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why there's always that kind of friction between theory or practice, or tension, if anyone specializes solely in one over the other. So when did you start or first work with Andrew Ehrenberg?
Oh, early 2000, when he'd left London Business School and he was supposed to retire, but he didn't. So he went to South Bank University because it was near his London South Bank University because it was near his house, and they gave him an office and things, and he continued, and then he got visited by these strange young Australians from the other side of the world.
Did he describe them as strange?
No, he didn't. But it must have seemed odd for him. Who are these people? How do they know me, and why have they turned up here? Oh, no, he liked it. It was great because, you know, we could get out and do things that it was hard for him to do at that stage in his life. And there were quite a few of us. I remember him explaining to probably the Dean of Research, saying, you know, I have a bit of a retirement home here on the South Bank. You know, I've got a few of my retired friends working with me. Well, Byron has sort of the opposite down in Adelaide. And the Dean went, what? Oh, a kindergarten.
Oh, wonderful.
We were quite young, but not kindergarten, no.
Okay. And how did you find that early experience? How did it differ to your time at Dun & Bradstreet and Ford?
I was fortunate enough to, I mean, I started doing some research and I started publishing. I realized I was quite good at it and it was quite fun. So I thought, this is pretty cool. People will actually pay me to just have to do a bit of teaching and they'll pay me to do this. So I don't know, I just fell into it. And I managed to convince, obviously I was quite keen on it and passionate about it, and managed to convince some colleagues to come join me, even though, you know, we had no funding or salaries and things. So it all turned out quite well and it led to the Ehrenberg Bass Institute.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then not that many years later, of course, you published How Brands Grow. I'm not going to ask you to explain the findings and the key science and laws within the book. But what was the reason and the intentions behind publishing the book? Was there just a natural fit?
Our European advisory board said, we want a book that we can put in the hands of the CEO and CFO and explain why we're, you know, trying to make these very big and difficult changes in marketing, you know, that there really is some science behind it. So it turned out to be very good advice. It wasn't something we really wanted to do at the time. But, you know, so we got Oxford University Press and made a nice looking hardcover. So that's what it was designed for. I sort of hoped it would sell. I didn't think it would ever sell a lot. I thought it would probably sell for a long time. I thought, you know, I mean, Rees & Trout's positioning book still sells. And so I thought, you know, I think I can write something that'll, you know, sell for decades.
And presumably there should be no shelf life on the science, right?
No, well, on those sort of fundamental things, I'd be, yeah, really surprised. So, yeah, so I did think it would sell for a long time, but I didn't expect it to be quite such a bestseller, if you like.
Yeah. And then presumably your own mental and, I suppose, physical availability skyrocketed after that, and you've been misquoted and misrepresented ever since.
Yeah. Not always, but you know, what does Taylor Swift say? You know, haters going to hate. You know, there's always going to issue. You're always going to have some.
Oh, exactly. Clearly, double jeopardy law is one of the key findings that fell out, key laws that fell out. I want to talk today, in part because of your comments about podcasts, but equally because Call to Action has never tried to be a Me Too podcast or same podcast. I should probably rebrand that too now. I want to talk about marketing blind spots. So given your history, your career to date, I want to understand, what do we still not know, Byron?
Oh, Enormous amounts.
Are there any key areas?
It's very hard to say what we don't know.
Well, we don't know them, do we, I suppose? What a terrible question. Are there any kind of currently unresearched areas that you're kind of finding yourself drawn to? Like whether it's something in the world of, I don't know, attention metrics seems to be obviously quite a topical one.
Oh, no, we've done quite a bit of research on that and others. That's actually sort of solved some time back. No, pricing is, I mean, we're about to issue a series of reports on pricing to our sponsors. We'll probably publicly be issuing some stuff on brand purpose, which has suddenly become very topical again after Cannes. Yeah, so those are of considerable interest to me at the moment because we're about to release them. But there's a lot of people in the institutes. There's a lot of stuff brought in where, 10 to 20 new people starting research degrees this year. So,
wow.
They will produce findings.
Yeah. One thing I've heard you talk about in a previous interview is the overlap of mental and physical availability.
Yeah, something that wasn't mentioned in How Brains Grow.
No. I wanted to talk to you or at least ask you where cognitive biases, so behavioral sciences and heuristics, where do they fit within Ehrenberg Bass's approach or consideration? Because it strikes me that the subtitle of your wonderful tome, How Brands Grow, is What Marketers Don't Know. And I feel like there's a bit of behavioral science around that subtitle. I wondered where the overlap is.
Probably does. It was Thomas Bain from Mountain View who told me, have a provocative subtitle that tells people, which wasn't really my style, but I thought, Then he said that was, based on behavioral science. Make people pick the book up. I cover it in our textbook, but it's not that big a story in marketing. Yes, consumers use heuristics. Some can lead to suboptimal things, but a lot are actually phenomenally useful to consumers. They let them decide faster and get on with their lives. It's not actually that big a story, the whole behavioral rebranding of psychology stuff as behavioral economics. But it certainly fits with the idea that we see in the behavioral patterns of loyalty, that consumers are polygamously loyal rather than exclusively, that they do like being loyal because it's a lovely heuristic, right? Where are my brands? I'm in the store. Where are my brands?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard, Phil Barden, who I'm sure you're familiar with, he uses the term no-brainer when someone is, say, in a shopping environment, a context of making a purchase, and they will opt for a brand that doesn't represent, like a significant, cognitive task where they're trying to process a new brand. So they go for familiarity. And you talk obviously about screening out. And to me, they're kind of almost the same thing, but seen through a different lens. Is that fair to say?
I think there's more to it than screening out, which I think people don't really get because what you don't notice, what you don't notice. So, people are, if you like, rushed or cognitive misers. But that's only a small part of the story. I mean, the screening out is an amazing phenomena that really, so it's more people being efficient rather than being lazy. And the implications for marketing are huge. I don't quite like the story of our consumers are just, they just buy the familiar sort of things if they're like robotic and just so lazy. It's not true. They're experienced purchases usually. They know where to get information. They know about the brands in the category. They're not idiots. It's not that they have no brain. They have a highly efficient brain designed to allow them to get on with their lives.
Yeah, that's fair. I think the two worlds kind of cross over into each. And I think Phil Barden is, I'm thinking of his book Decoded, The Science Behind Why We Buy. So I suppose it's two different worlds of science, but maybe they sort of creep and overlap. And make conclusions.
Yeah, but it's different. But they don't lead to predictions. Like they would never predict the double jeopardy law. And
true,
because that's something that is something profoundly weird and non-intuitive, and yet generalizes so well across so many things that we can make predictions. We can make outlandish predictions that with incredible accuracy that come true, like the Institute predicting that Wells Fargo was not an amazing cross-selling company and did not have higher loyalty than other banks. And to my knowledge, no one else was predicting that. People might have had their doubts of that Wells Fargo were performing so well, but no one was predicting that you just could not do it because there was a scientific law. And, you know, it turned out the great fraud, I checked the figures, it's actually ended up costing Wells Fargo $7 billion US dollars in fines because
wow,
their staff just made up. They made up the cross-selling.
Yeah. So you must see stories like that and just be do you find yourself being naturally cynical then when you see these types of stories? I mean, cynical is probably an unfair word because it sounds negative when actually you're just seeing the truth within it.
So what sort of stories? Like Wells Fargo for 10 years putting in their annual reports. No, we just thought it was like really interesting that that would break a scientific law. And so we went there. We can see no reason for that. We've published on that. We've studied banks. No, it won't be. So, you know, we published and said, no, it's got to be fake. But we didn't think they were doing fraud, but it turned out there was massive fraud. That's how they achieved it.
Yeah. And then with your kind of, from your scientific background.
That's amazing. I mean, I don't think the marketing community quite, there's a lot of superficial readers of How Brands Grow, if you like, or people go, oh, yeah, yeah. Someone yesterday said, they wrote about Double Jeopardy and they said, you know, obviously, it's very intuitive. If you think it's intuitive, then you do not understand it because it is absolutely not intuitive. It is absolutely not intuitive that a small group of people, that if a brand, you know, if a brand or celebrity or something is known by a small group of people, that those people will not have high liking or high loyalty for it, that they cannot. That doesn't seem to make sense at all. I mean, niche brands make sense, right? Small brands that have a passionate tribe of loyalists who follow them. We go, yeah, that makes total sense. I'm sure there's behavioral economics theories that explain why that happens, except it doesn't. Right? The Double Jeopardy is really weird. Double Jeopardy says we can predict how the loyalty levels for that group by knowing their penetration level compared to other brands. That's weird. I mean, we now understand why, but it is pretty weird. The real world is, I always like to say, is a very weird place.
Yes.
Scientific theories that sound intuitive are usually wrong. There's nothing about relativity, electromagnetism, quantum mechanics that is intuitive.
True. And it needs to replicate. I listened to a lovely interview you gave not so long ago where you said people don't go to Argentina and ask about Argentinian gravity.
Yeah, that's the powerful thing. So scientific theory is able to make predictions, and that's how we know it works. You know, you get, you know, the sort of, you sometimes get these smart aleck sort of comments that people, a little bit of knowledge is the dangerous thing, and you get smart alecks who say things like, oh, this marketing science, you know, science can't prove anything because it's based on induction. I learned that in my, you know, philosophy of science class, whatever. And you're like, yes, it is based on induction, but that has never turned out to be a practical problem for science. When you can predict something over and over, it's very reliable. And that's why planes fly and computers compute, and because we can make predictions. That's real science. There's a lot of theory that sounds plausible, but it can't make predictions. Only explains afterwards why someone won an election or a football game or something. Only afterwards.
Yeah.
But real science is quite amazing. You can make predictions to, you know, that's why people were amazed by Darwin, Newton, sorry. Simple laws of movement could actually predict for billiard balls on a billiard table, as well as like planets swinging around the sun. That just seemed just spooky. And science is, it can blow your mind. Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard people, when they refer to the Double Jeopardy law, they almost extrapolate their own conclusions from it. And I've certainly been guilty of that myself, so I'm not pointing fingers. But one of the ones that I've definitely said in the past, and I wonder if it's a little bit chicken and egg, not chicken and egg, it's like cart before the horse, in as much as big brands tend to have an advantage because they would have a more mature marketing function within the business, or at least a more developed marketing department and function within the business. Is there any truth to that, or is that just kind of it has to be true for a brand to be big? They have to have an established mature function?
Not really. I don't think so, because, you know, very very new companies like, I don't know, SpaceX or something, probably don't.
Yeah, true.
It's more age rather than size. You know, big brands have more resources, but they also have bigger targets. People say, oh, it's easier for Coca-Cola. You're like, what's easy about it? Coca-Cola has to sell like a billion drinks next quarter. Like, how would you like that, Target? So, no, there's nothing about that. There's no, Double Jeopardy does not say big brands have any sort of advantage. Double Jeopardy doesn't. The law of Double Jeopardy just says this is what a big brand has to look like. It has to have a much bigger customer base.
Yeah.
And that's really insightful. But it doesn't say that that brand has necessarily going to stay big. It doesn't say a small brand is necessarily inherently doomed or weak. It doesn't say anything about that. So that is, I think, perhaps what you're alluding to, that people start layering on their own theory of, you know, strength. I hate this term, strong brands, that we use all the time in marketing. A strong brand. What does that mean? So it's one of those, you know, absolutely pointless strong brand. What is a strong brand? Do you mean it's big?
So presumably it must have high mental and physical availability, right? It's as simple as that.
That is definitely an advantage, yes. Well, it makes you big, yes. But Double Jeopardy doesn't tell us that. That's the theory that happens to fit with these laws, yes.
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on building a funnel. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
I've heard a claim, and I hope I'm repeating it accurately, from LinkedIn, where they talk about big brands almost win by accident.
I don't know what that means.
I think it's more the advantage of size, the advantage of being a big brand, strong brand, whatever you want to call it.
I mean, on average, a big brand's future is that it will lose market share.
Yeah.
And look, we've done a lot of study of tiny, tiny, tiny little brands, which the research isn't in the public domain. But I can tell you, it is quite amazing how many tiny brands just keep on surviving.
Yeah.
And you'd look and you'd say, but surely they're weak. Well, they probably like to grow, and not many of them manage to do that. But nor do they just all fall out of the market. No.
Yeah. We've touched on, I've certainly been guilty, I think it's quite clear, of some misconceptions. I had a question from Lee Grinnell. In your experience, what are the biggest misconceptions that people have about marketing science and evidence-based marketing?
Well, a dangerous one is that they think it means you should get some evidence, rather than that it does not mean that. I stole the term from evidence-based medicine, which occurred and came into the literature in 1992, and said, it did not say that doctors should get some evidence, because doctors have been using evidence for, you know, centuries. They usually do ask you, you know, which leg hurts, or what were you doing before it started hurting? And, you know, they gather data. But no, what evidence-based medicine meant that clinical practice should be informed by the best scientific knowledge that we currently have. And it was a plea for, clinicians to base hospital best practice on the scientific literature, which got quite a lot of pushback from the medicos at the time, because they felt this was undermining their artistic experience and things, that they weren't qualified to read scientific literature and things. All sort of similar things that we've had with evidence-based marketing. But so that's a big misconception. You just think, well, yes, we live in an age with lots of data, so we're much more evidence-based. No, that doesn't mean we're more scientific. Right? That just means we're drowning in data. There's a huge difference.
Yeah, I mean, I gave back to the Professor Malcolm Wright word I used earlier, I think, perhaps.
Yeah, science produces some weird but law-like patterns that generalize. And if you don't know about those, yes, it's like not knowing about Newton's laws, right? And being an engineer, you need to know, because they tell us that the real world is weird and non-intuitive, but it is predictable.
Yes.
That's pretty important. I mean, today it seems astonishing that anyone could write a brand plan that proposed for growth and did not know about Double Jeopardy. I mean, would you hire someone to write a brand plan if they didn't know about Double Jeopardy?
No, absolutely not. I mean, we kind of force feed people certain texts when they join.
Right.
It's to be short.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Like, when I went to university, that's quite a long time ago, but, you know, like, really, well, prior to How Brands Grow being published, I mean, brand plans were being written all the time, right? And people were totally ignorant. Even the, you know, Nielsens and Kantars of this world were pretty much, I mean, they never told their clients about it.
Yes. No, I think that's true. I think that's, and it's still obviously the case. And I would dare to say, speaking as the owner of an agency our size, so the lower end of the spectrum, I think it's far more frequent than we would want to be the case, simply because the people who are, I suppose, marking the homework, if we stick with that metaphor, similarly haven't heard of the double jeopardy laws, or even, dare I say, how brands grow, sadly.
Right. Yeah. But some people have, yeah. But other people, you know, the Wells Fargo is a, you know, lovely case of extremely well-paid. I guess they felt that they deserved it, bankers, who did not know about double jeopardy, and so thought, truly believed that their staff were just excelling at cross-selling, and that their customers were just so much more loyal than any other customers of any other bank. Whereas if they had known about double jeopardy, someone would have done like I did and wrote, this probably isn't true. Maybe we should just check our figures.
Yeah.
Maybe we should check those accounts. Like, are they really real?
Can I ask, at the risk of pressing a massive big red button, what are your thoughts on synthetic research?
I wrote something recently because people have been saying things like synthetic data, made up data. Yeah.
Yes.
That, you know, it can get, you know, like, oh, someone said, you know, 90% the accuracy of survey. And I mean, well, I can write a bit of code that'll give you 90% match to survey data. I mean, that's not actually very hard. And that's not why you do surveys. I mean, you usually, you know, you have a lot of prior knowledge usually, like that Coca-Cola is a very big brand and that, you know, Mountain Dew is a very, very small brand. You know a whole lot of things already. That's not why you're doing market research. You do market research for that, you know, few percent of surprising, like, oh, okay, that's odd. I wonder why that is. That's why you do market research. So why would you use... I mean, that will never occur in synthetic data, right? The synthetic data will conform to the knowledge that you have. It will not produce those weird discoveries.
Yeah. What I say, like, surprise, it can't find surprising truths.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
I mean,
yeah.
I can predict that if you have more of your customers in the survey, then your satisfaction score will be higher. In fact, any sort of perceptual score will be higher, reflecting that there are more your customers in the survey. I mean, we know these things. They're very predictable. I can predict that any customer, any attitudinal score, any customer satisfaction score, NPS, whatever, will be massively upward skewed, right? We know this. I can make synthetic data that matches all that. Fine.
Yeah.
And it'll just tell me what I already know. And it'll never tell me about something weird that suddenly appeared in the marketplace that might be important.
Yeah, I think I've said before that it feels to me like there's a contradiction in terms when it comes to the word synthetic and whether it's not necessarily research, but data or certainly accurate data.
It's going to produce those things like, you know, the things where you do the personality profile where you go, so, yeah, you know, you're generally a good person. You like other people, but you also like some time for yourself and some privacy sometimes. And you do this sort of spiel and you ask people, so how did that profile fit you? And people go, oh, that's incredible. It's so insightful. Yeah. That is me. You go, I've just described a human.
Yeah, we're back to horoscopes, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing is, that is because that sort of personality profile will fit 99% of people on the planet. What's really interesting is the 1% that doesn't, that you go, oh my God, you're a psycho killer or whatever. So that's what real world data is. That's why you do market research.
Yeah. Great answer. I'm going to allow enough time to weave a few more listener questions in. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. Right. We've got dozens. I'm just going to throw a few at you in no particular order. Okay. A good friend of both of ours, Kirti Nair, the wonderful Special K, she has asked, what have you recently changed your mind on?
Ah, we all think, you know, the European stereotypes, right? We think, you know, Germans are, you know, efficient and more rational. And he says, someone, when I was in Düsseldorf, someone, you're going to Munich. Oh, that's down south. You must realize, so they're crazy down there. They're not really German. They're practically Italian, you know. They're very emotional. Like, what?
That's amazing.
It's just a difference in perspective. Like, okay, well... So I learned something. I'm not sure I sort of changed my mind, but the stereotype is more nuanced. Sorry, that's yes. The thing of just came to mind.
Yeah, no, that's lovely.
Something in marketing. Well, let me, you can talk about the fake differentiation debate. We were doing some experiments and we wanted to have some brands that were, you know, really differentiated compared to some others. And the interesting thing is every time we were like putting these subsets of brands in, we could think of reasons why every single brand was differentiated. Right? Okay, oh, but wait on, but that one might be that. And the weird thing is when we put it into the market, like looking at people's perceptions and actual reactions actually in some of these experiments, the brands weren't behaving at all like they were differentiated. It's like, right. Oh, wow, that's a very interesting perspective. Maybe we overthink things as marketers. And so, you know, we look at something and go, oh, well, you know, that could be, and that might be. And yeah, so I think that's quite fascinating. I do remember years ago when Jay Singh and Andrew Ehrenberg they looked at Double Jeopardy for variants. So this is not brands. This is SKUs, right? So looking at things like big pack, small pack, medium sure. pack, you know, with washer, you know, thing that had no dyes and, you know, low allergy versus normal, whatever. And they found that Double Jeopardy fit very well. Basically, the most popular variant was bought by more people and they were a bit more loyal. I do remember at the time going, oh, but wait, Andrew, this is mind-blowing because we say that, you know, you get an MBD Dirichlet world, you know, you get patterns like Double Jeopardy because the brands aren't terribly differentiated because they all match each other with the SKUs. Like, you know, every ice cream brand has chocolate and vanilla and strawberry, right? So, but these variants, they really are different, right? It's a big pack size. It's a medium pack size. It's a small pack size. That's different. Like, well, that should break Double Jeopardy. But then it dawned on me that, yeah, but actually for consumers, it's like, you know, well, there's the big pack of Oreos, there's the medium pack of Oreos, and there's a small pack of Oreos. They're all packs of Oreos. Oh, well, yeah, but this one's got 16 biscuits and this one's got 32. And they're like, yeah. And I can buy two packs of the 16 and then they've got 32. I mean, really, it's not, you know, and sometimes I buy the big and sometimes I buy the medium. And
yeah.
Actually, mostly I buy the medium. Yeah. You know, and like, oh, geez. Yeah. Okay. And so this is that's why we get this. It is a very, again, bizarre empirical discovery, completely did not fit marketing theory, that most brands behave in the marketplace as if, you know, consumers don't really see a lot of difference between them. I mean, obviously they see a difference between a Tesla and a Toyota Corolla, you know, a Ferrari and a Toyota Corolla. But yeah, we know that. But no, for rival brands, yeah, they don't really. And those brands can be highly successful, multi-billion, you know, Oreo is a good example, right? Multi-billion dollar, you know, brands. They don't need that. No, that is an astonishing finding. So the fake differentiation debate is where you get people going, oh, well, first of all, this really tiresome one where they go, Ehrenberg Bass says there's no differentiation. It's like, well, right. Okay. Can you go back and read the books? You say it's a total myth that the brands are just commodities. No, there's definitely differentiation. But the astounding empirical finding is, but the overall level of perceived differentiation is surprisingly low. It doesn't seem to be anywhere near as big a marketing story. That's really surprising. But there clearly are, you know, brands that are differentiated. But it doesn't seem to, like, you know, mean they inherit the earth or do particularly well. It's not a must-have requirement. That's really surprising. And then the sort of fake thing is people who come in and say, well, we've got the special data that shows that if you're differentiated, you do super, super, super well. And it's always very weird. You know, when you push them, the data suddenly is unavailable or disappears or was tortured to death. Because we've got open, you know, anyone can do it. You can do a survey and see. Brands don't compete as if they're terribly differentiated, except for the, you know, few that do. And they're usually, you know, like very high priced, very high quality, or very low priced. You know, Aldi is certainly a differentiated brand, but not as much as we might like to think. But yeah. So I would say that marketers should stop wasting money on, like, have we tweaked up our differentiation? Is it, you know, like, it, no, you've either got something. You just ask your mum, okay? She'll tell you. I mean, seriously, you know, ask a 12-year-old, and the 12-year-old will go, Ford, Toyota, nah.
Yeah. Totally.
Ford, Ferrari, yep. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm going to have one more. and the fake different shows. It's people selling something that everyone wants to believe. With cunning advertising, you can dial up the differentiation of your brand. No, not really. Consumers are pretty experienced and they're not stupid. No, it's a lovely, I think it's what we all want to believe, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, but you can dial up mental availability and you can get more physical availability, and that's what you should really be trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think people just, I suppose, again, I've been guilty of just zooming in too closely on things and feeling they're huge, but it's just because you're zoomed in on it, whether it's differentiation or whatever it might be.
And it feeds into marketing's attitude problem, this idea that our growth will be unlocked if we can just solve the fact that we're not, say, cool enough or hip enough or liked enough. That's really the thing. We have to tell people they're stupid. They don't know how good and wonderful our brand is. We need to do that. Where it's like, are they? A few people who buy you know you, and most people don't buy you because they don't even know who you are.
Yeah. I liked actually a recent interview, I think it was a couple of years ago now, where you just said, kind of unpacking Double Jeopardy a little bit, but you were effectively just saying that, you know, buyers of big brands haven't heard of the small brand, whereas buyers of the small brand have likely heard of the big brand. I think it's when you unpack things like that, that's when people think, oh yeah, that's like intuitive, whereas the actual, you know, whole fighting yourself wasn't.
Yes, yes, that's explaining the statistical selection effect. Yeah,
sure. Yeah. Going back slightly a few minutes to your Oreo skills.
Yes.
I've had a great question. This gets a little bit deeper, but it's a great question from Graham, who says, I've seen a lot of content questioning the validity of how brands grow recently, particularly related to the B2B space, e.g. one of Dale Harrison's posts on LinkedIn, which hurt my head. Question one, much of your advice stems from the MBD Dirichlet model, which assumes a fixed average basket size. A fair assumption in FMCG.
No, it doesn't seem. I think he's referring to some people who really like smart asses, you know, where they know a little bit about things. And so they say things like, oh, the MBD Dirichlet is a stationary model.
Ah, okay.
And you're like, yes, it is. Well, that doesn't sound very good.
Okay.
It's a stationary model. What that means is at its heart, it assumes a particular statistical distribution of purchase propensities or loyalties. And it says they're fixed, right? Which we know is not. I was talking to Pete Fader at Wharton last week about this, right? I mean, we know that sometimes people change their loyalties, right? They suddenly adopt a new brand or they move house, and I don't know, Tesco was the closest to their house and now Sainsbury is, right? So they revise their loyalties. And we know that happens. The amazing thing of the MBD Dirichlet is it assumes they're all fixed and it's able to make predictions, like for any brand, it's metrics like the proportion of people who buy this week, who will rebuy the following week, proportion of your heavy buyers that will still be heavy next to you, and how many of them will come medium. It can make these predictions, and like it predicts double jeopardy law and duplication of purchase law, and it gets it right. So what that tells us is about the real world is the real world is not about fixed loyalties, propensities. But obviously, in the short, medium term, most people, they're pretty fixed. Right? And so that's quite, oh, wow, okay. A lot of stability there. Wow, okay. Well, yeah, okay. Well, I guess it does make sense. You know, you're not going to shift away from Tesco until you, like, move house. So, you know, if that's your, most people have a first store loyalty thing. And so if that's your, the biggest brand in crypto, I was probably going to stay the biggest brand until you move house, and that doesn't happen very often. Okay, so it gives us deep insight to the world. Now it's a real smart. There are people out there who, oh my god, they think they're mathematical geniuses, but they're not at all, and they just don't understand. You know, trot out words like yes, not it's stationary.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yes, it is. Yep, we've written about it. Yep, it's like. Hundreds of academic articles you can write about it. No one's hiding it. It's you haven't discovered something. It's like people who say they've discovered, I've discovered this brand has more loyalty than this one. It's like, congratulations, you've discovered the double in Double Jeopardy.
Yeah.
Big brands have a little bit more loyalty. Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Good stuff.
But what is it? Taylor Swift is right. Haters gonna hate. There's people, people making these things on LinkedIn are usually like, you know, consultants in a company of one, and that they leverage if they can say something provocative about the Aaron Mabass Institute, then they get attention.
Yeah.
And of course, it annoys us when we're like, oh, that person's just, I mean, it's called trolling, isn't it? Where you're really just deliberately trying to shine the spotlight on yourself by saying something negative about Taylor Swift. And this, you know, annoys particularly the, you know, younger researchers and institutes. Like, how can they say something so stupid? And we should correct them, but it's hard. They're always going to exist.
Have you heard the saying, unrelated to this last question, but more of a kind of comment, I suppose, on that type of marketing debate that is just too, or marketing trolling, which is too rife. Have you heard of the saying about arguing with idiots is like playing chess with a pigeon? No matter how well you play, the pigeon is going to shit all over the board and act like it won anyway.
Yeah, Andrew Ehrenberg did once say to me, be careful of arguing with a fool, because from a distance, people can't tell who's the fool.
That's really smart. Yeah, I love that.
I'm not sure Andrew always kept to that his own advice, though.
No, it's hard to. But I'm constantly quoting that to friends, especially when they've been on LinkedIn for too long.
But, you know, it's good for people to criticize and ask, you know, the ones that are annoying and are the ones who are just making stuff up. But asking questions like, does this apply in B2B? That's show us some evidence on that. You know, these are very legitimate questions.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, we did have a few of those. I mean, people asking, you know, small B2B brands suffer from fewer buyers and lower basket size and weaker repeat. What does that mean for growth strategy? Are mass reach and broad availability still the right play? Or should account-based or segmentation-led strategies get more credit?
You come up with a creative way to increase your mental and physical availability, but you have to do it.
Yeah.
What Double Jeopardy and the things of the fit of the negative binomial distribution tell us is you can't just hive off a tiny part of the customer base and just focus on them. And yeah, that's really quite surprising. Like, well, why can't I? Why can't I just talk to my friends or the customers who like me, the ones with the high propensity to buy, etc.? It's like, nope. You can, but not if you want to grow. If you want to grow, the really perverse thing is, if you want to grow, you really have to recruit low propensity to buy you people. Like on a B2B, they're probably light because they buy from your competitors and bigger competitors. You've got to recruit them. You've got to your mix of customers will look exactly the same when you're bigger. It's just that there'll be more of them, and so there'll be lights and mediums and heavies, but there'll be just more of them. You can't just say, "Well, we're just going to focus on the heavies." Like, you can't. It's weird, isn't it? Right. I mean, it's weird, right? You go, well, that doesn't feel right, but it is. I'm sorry, you can't build an anti-gravity machine. It's just like, you got gravity, okay? You gotta live with it.
The science exists in Argentina too. I am going to move to, I suppose.
That reminds me of something we were talking about today. That's a lovely, at a time, I don't know when it was, the 50s or something, when there were lots of reports of flying saucers and things. This is so French, right? Down in the southern France and Rhone, some council went, well, what if a flying saucer landed on the vineyards during vintage? We can't have that. So they passed a law against it.
Wow. They passed a law. That's so perfect.
This is so French. It's like, what if the aliens don't read the law?
Do they answer to our laws too? Wow, that is absolutely wonderful.
It features on there's a Californian wine label. I think it's Bonnie Doon, very wickedly funny winemaker, and he wanted to make a wine that mimicked south of France. So he put on his label a picture of a UFO over a vineyard to celebrate this great story.
Oh, it's a lovely story. We've got Nick Asbury to thank for the next one. Big fan of Nick. I know you are too, despite his Liverpool Football Club allegiances.
He's a very good writer and a very good thinker, yes.
Oh, he's incredibly, incredibly good thinker and writer. Does Byron think there is a place for awards in the industry? Can they serve a positive purpose? And is it a problem for the empirical research that he does when so many case studies are based on flimsy evidence?
First of all, I think we should have awards, and we should have awards particularly for, you know, great implementation. In advertising, right? So we know what our goal is. It's to reach all category buyers and just embed or refresh some memory structures that make it easier for them to buy. So we should have awards that celebrate when that occurs. But a lot of award criteria is terrible.
Lord, yeah.
and there's fraud and there's overly wrought, you know, overly worked judges. And so, I mean, yeah, it's a bit of a mess, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Same, even effectiveness awards have their problems too, right? I mean, it's hugely based on, I remember reading one and they said they turned around this thing of this launch of this car and there was this one little line about, well, yes, they did reduce the price by 30%, but we don't think that had anything to do with it because other people ran discounts too. Wow. What?
Wow. Let's just dismiss that one.
Of course, it was just the advertising. A 30% price decrease. What could that do?
Jesus. Yeah, we harvested it all with a price slash, but that didn't have anything to do with it. Bizarre. Very bizarre. Yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame the state of the awards in the industry, but I believe it's no different to other industries, sadly. Pay-to-play models are bound to be abused.
Yeah. But I think there are some very good within company award things. Mm. And I think would really encourage awards to be based on what we learned, you know, even if, okay, we did this and actually we made them, you know, in hindsight, we probably should have done X and Y and we didn't, but at least we learned that. And people should win awards for that rather than, oh, well, it didn't work. You're an idiot. You know, we should reward failure as well as success as long as there's learning so that the company is going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I had a wonderful guest actually on the pod about 3, maybe 4 years ago. It was during the pandemic. And she used to run pre-COVID. It was a really, really successful event, largely for like kind of investors, called the Fuck Up Meetup. And the only rule was you could only talk about, you know, catastrophic errors you had made in your career. And unsurprisingly, it was really, really popular because it just had this kind of edge of honesty that is too rare to find in the business world. But of course, it did exactly what you just said. It shared, you know, learnings from mistakes, right? Which is kind of what life is, right?
Yeah, I mean, it should. So I think awards, good, yeah. But they obviously need to be based on some data that we can actually trust. And I think, I mean, next to him at Cannes in particular, right? It's just too big, isn't it? It's a mad circus. They have thousands and thousands of entries. I mean, I know they make their money out of it, but they can't handle it. They've just bitten off more than they can chew.
Yeah, I read somewhere, what was their turnover this year? Something like, I don't know, tens if not hundreds of millions of pounds were made in award entries alone.
Right.
So the size of the business is vast. Byron, I'm mindful that we haven't got long left. I typically we go to our 4 pertinent poses, but I'm going to slash those, maybe cut them in 2, if I may, just to squeeze them in.
It's your podcast. You can do whatever you like.
So I'm going to skip the first 2. I feel like we've done those justice, but I am going to ask, are there any books that you would recommend to our listeners, aside from How Brands Grow and its wonderful sequel with Jenny Womanek, who we're huge fans of?
Yes, I always recommend Phil Rosenzweig, I think is how you pronounce his name. He's an IMD mm-hmm. University professor there, and he wrote The Halo Effect and 8 Management Delusions or something. But even if you only read the chapter on The Halo Effect, it's just fabulously sobering about how business journalists, there's this halo. If the company's doing well, they describe everything that's doing as therefore great. Right? Anything they do must be great. It's like the fallacy of thinking that, you know, because the Roman generals, you know, consulted chicken entrails and things, that's why the Roman army was so good. And then instant that company's performance dips, it reverses. So people, you know, so when they're doing well and they buy another company, people say, well, that's brave diversification. You know, like if anything goes wrong, they suddenly say it was terribly risky. You know, and so you start to realize it's, wow, sort of making stuff up afterwards, which also relates to Duncan Watt's very excellent book, Everything is Obvious Once You Know It, I think it is.
Yeah.
I'd recommend Nate Silver's book on, pretty hefty, on forecasting. Anyone should, particularly the, you know, the thing of statistical modeling and the dangers of overfitting, because I think a lot of marketers think that things like marketing mix modeling is science, and it's not. Yes, there's a few that are not a lot. I mean, the typical bookshelf section in a business, you know, it's terrible, isn't it? It's they're mostly self-help books and get rich quick type books.
Yeah. Apart from Adele Writes an Ad, obviously.
Oh, Adele Writes an Ad. It's a wonderful book. Everyone should buy that book.
There we go. Appreciate that.
Well,
thank you.
Give it to their children or do what we did and give them out to schools. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. No, well, well done for that, because that's a wonderful thing. And then lastly, is we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest who has to give the reason why. So would you kindly dedicate this episode to somebody?
Oh, I'm going to dedicate the episode to John Scriven, who worked at the Institute with Andrew Ehrenberg for some years. And then he took retirement and had a heart attack like immediately on the golf course. So,
Jesus. I mean,
you could say great way to go, terrible. But yeah, no, that's a lesson. Don't retire. Because we've been recently replicating some of John's work in pricing. And, you know, it really is quite amazing research that probably 99.9% of academics, even if they do anything in pricing, aren't aware of. So I dedicate this episode to John Scriven.
Fantastic. Well, this episode is very proudly dedicated to John Scriven. Thank you, Byron. So everyone listening, if you head over to the listing, we're going to share links to all of the books that Byron just recommended. Byron's own work, of course, and the Ehrenberg Bass Institute. We'll also link to How Brands Grow Live for Executives. Feel free to add a little bit more detail on that, Byron. But how else can our listeners get more Byron Sharp?
Well, How Brands Grow Live is amazing. As you say, you can't ask a book questions, and but if you go to How Brands Grow Live, it's, you know, it's premium top business school executive development, where, you know, a very small curated group of participants get to spend, you know, 3 days with people like me and Professor Jenny Romanek and other researchers from the Ehrenberg Bass Institute, going through a brilliantly designed program and being able to ask questions and come up and, you know, devise marketing, creative marketing strategies for their own business. So it's in Boston next, and then we'll be again in Singapore and Bordeaux and Boston next year.
Amazing. And presumably people can find more about that on the Ehrenberg Bass Institute's website.
They certainly can.
Perfect.
Yeah, you can actually get a qualification from the Ehrenberg Bass Institute.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, people don't sort of realize that. Yeah.
Well, hopefully there'll be a few thousand, at least tens of thousands perhaps, that now know. Amazing. So lastly, just Byron, just to reiterate my thanks. It's a very unsociable hour where you are.
My stomach just rumbled. It's telling me.
But thank you. And thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the pod. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email The Mouthful. That is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action. But I try, and I try, and I try, and I try. Yeah, hey, hey.